thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me to Ro and Michael and the rest of the Jikochi gang. My last Dharma talk here was 25 years ago. So it's nice to be back. I met Coben in the early 80s. I took a calligraphy class with him in Palo Alto. And two of the characters we were practicing, one was Dao for Taoism, and the other one was Buddha. So I was a wise guy coming from academia. I asked him, what's the difference, Coben? So he looked at me and he said, no difference, and walked away. I never heard an answer like that. I was hooked. I have read about Buddhism, in books and stories, but this is the first time I met a real Zen person. So shortly after that, there was an opening here at Jikochi, and my wife and I applied. We were accepted, and we stayed 3 years. Then I got my roksu and my walking papers, my little stick, and off I went. However, even though I had an intellectual understanding of the Dharma, I didn't feel that I had a real understanding of it. And there are many, or at least two Zen traditions of students, once the masters give them their approval, they disappear and practice for 25 years. One of them, Michael mentioned, Huineng, and the other one I was familiar with was Xiao Shu. He also did the same thing, so I said, okay, I'll try this and test my mettle and see if the Dharma works or not. Well, it works. So this is supposed to be a progress report on practice. And basically the main obstacle to the practice was me, myself, my ego, as always gets in the way. And it's a very insidious adversary, you would say. And besides the usual stuff, the Heart Sutra and the precepts, one of my favorites, signpost for practice is the song of the third patriarch, or the sensing me, or the mind heart. What is it? Faith in mind chant. So this little booklet, only 116 pages, lines, many different translations. And the first line says, the great way is easy for those who have no preferences. Make the slightest distinction on heaven and earth and separated, infinitely apart. So that's pretty straight instruction. No preferences. So I try that on my everyday life. Even when you go to a restaurant and you order something and you don't get what you order, well, I'll just eat it. And it's amazing because it starts little by little chipping at your ego when you don't make decisions, and you don't assert yourself. The other one also in this little book that I also cherish says, do not seek after the truth. Rather, stop cherishing opinions. And that's a little tougher because I'm very attached to my opinions. And for the precepts, the one that resonate with me are, of course, the ones I have most trouble with. There's the one about not finding fault in others, number 10, not to defame the Dharma, which in Bodhidharma's words are not to make a distinction between ordinary being or sages or being a guru or being a regular man or person. And then, when you study Buddhism, Well, the first, the three basic truths are, of course, you will know this, but catechism. First one is dukkha, or suffering, and trying to live an ordinary life, which is also another one of our tenets, you know, nothing special. What we do is nothing special, just totally ordinary. Lots of dukkha comes along in ordinary life, not just a few ones. Divorce, alcoholism, unemployment, disability, surgeries. The list goes on and on. You just can't get away from it. But it's all right. Let's just live. The other one, anicca, impermanence. And oh boy, coming to Chicoche, I see how everything changes. Nothing stays the same. And even though my mind feels that it's the same mind I had 25 years ago, I know it can't possibly be. I used to ride a bike. I used to dance. I used to swim. All those things, they no longer happen. Only, as Michael says, in my mind I can do all those things or I can go anywhere. But in reality, you know, it just, especially after my last surgery, I just sat for 4 months recovering in my room. It was a wonderful retreat. Another one that signpost that helps me to beat down my ego is this leaving no traces, which is sort of countercultural because we always want to put our name and say, I did this, right, that, and this is my legacy. But in the long run, you know, that, none of that is worth a bag of beans, as they say. And what happened when I came to the Zendo, I sort of lost all my personal ambition. I was in a PhD program. And then after being here for a while, I said to myself, well, what's a true man of no rank doing seeking after degrees? So I just had no interest in doing that. It just fell off. At one time, I was making translations of the of our liturgy into Spanish, but I was always checking, you know, what's the motivation for this? And it really wasn't, you know, to save all sentient beings. It's just, it was to make a name for myself. Jorge did the translations. So I lost interest in that too, after it became clear that that was the reason why I was doing that. And another problems with my practice is self-delusion. It's very hard to tell when you're really doing the right thing or you're doing it for the Dharma or you for some other reason that perhaps you're not even aware of. When Kogu was here, he had a calligraphy that had said, no shame, no blame, which is one of the emotional states that they recommend in this practice. And I have found out when people try to put the blame on you, if you tell them, oh, I am entirely to blame, suddenly they become taken aback. They say, oh, no, no, you can't be totally to blame. I must have a part in it. But if you say that, you know, it sort of disarms that argument. And my main interest in in Buddhism was be one of the universal religions like Christianity and Islam. It's like AA, it applies to anybody, you know. It's, as it says, universal. Anybody can take it. It's not like you have to be Jewish, be born Jewish, or you have to be born Hindu. And I'm so glad that today we chanted in English, you know, because when we chant the Heart Sutra in Japanese, you know, I have no idea what's going on. And when I was at Chikoji, there was a strong interest in things Japanese, you know. I felt that that really wasn't the way to do things. So, you know, we're grateful that we got it from Kobe, and to, I guess, Dogen came down to us, but this philosophy or this dharma is, you know, the thought of an Indian priest and or an Indian prince, and then Bodhidharma took it to China, and he was there a couple of hundred years before he got transported to Japan, and he got to us a few decades ago. But the ideas are universal. You know, they has to do with being a human being. It has nothing to do with chanting in a particular language or aping the forms of how Buddhism gets transplanted in a different place. I talked to Jerome, I think. He asked me, how come I didn't stay at Chikoji, you know, after I did my stint? And it was, first of all, there were different circumstances, you know. I felt that I already done my stint here and I should free up the space for other people who have the same opportunity. Plus, you know, staying at Chikoji, there's nothing between the priest and the abbot, and there was a lot of people ahead of me to be abbot, and Kobe was still alive, so there was no future there, no short-term future, so I decided just to go and practice on my own. The other practice I found helpful is when, on the way of the Bodhisattva, they talked about the good emotions or states of being that one should try to dwell into. First one is Karuna, which is, next one is Metta, which are the kindness and compassion or love. And the next two are the ones that are more challenging for me. One is equanimity, which we all know what it means. We don't get excited trying to keep an even keel. In other traditions, we call that boring. You know? But for us, being equanimous is not being boring at all. And the last one is sympathetic joy. That's when, you know, you feel happy when good things happen to other people and not yourself. And with practice, you can get there. I think in German there's an opposite state of mind. I think it's called Schadenfreude. It's when you're happy when bad things happen to other people. So the opposite of sympathetic joy tells you what the culture is. Is that true? And finally, anatman, which is the other truth, is being non-self, which is sort of counterintuitive because we all feel we exist. Usually, I feel that my ego occupies my whole body. But things have happened with that. The feeling that your body occupies you, your whole organism disappears. Even before Buddhism, when I took acid once, my ego began to shrink, you know. It didn't occupy my whole body. It occupied just a small amount. And the rest of my body was sort of on its own, and it was scary. And then, one of my surgeries, I had a near-death experience. It was an emergency surgery, and when I got to this, a different consciousness came over me. It was like a panoramic consciousness, the best way to describe it. You know, it was a new thing. It was perceptual. And unfortunately, it only lasted for about 4 to 6 months, and then my habits came back, and my ego is in total control. That one mind is just a memory, but I know it's there. And one of the things that perhaps you have experienced or you will experience at one time is the feeling that you're seeing the whole picture. Like if I go to an event, I will be at the event, but I will also see myself in the event. Like it's like if you're a musician, you play your lines, but I had the whole score kind of thing. When people came and talked, I could perceive their scripts, especially when I was at the hospital. Which it would be great, you know, I mean, if you're a con man or something. I shared this with Angie, and Angie says, don't use that for evil things, or which, you know, it was the furthest from my mind. I just went to the handle saying, what's happening, Angie? And then, of course, I went and reread my books, and there are descriptions of that. They call it one mind. But still, what really bugs the most out of me is that it went away after. If I had any advice for you, I would say to be sincere in your practice. And don't do it for gaining or for something else. You just, that's half the game right there if you're sincere in your practice. Your intention is really paramount in this business. And I'm very happy to see, first of all, so many people. I didn't think there were going to be so many people. And then so many young people, or at least younger than me. So our tradition is alive and kicking. Besides, personally, my personality or my ego being a hindrance in my practice, I have found out that my attachment to my children is also a hindrance in my practice. You know, I read that a lot in Milarepa. He says how terrible it was that he had a sister and he had to worry about her, you know. And I still haven't beaten that. I'm still very attached to my children, even though I'm alienated with some of them, and it goes back and forth. Maybe next lifetime. Yes, sir.
Good. Could you repeat that, please, about your children?
Being attached to my children is a hindrance in my practice. Because I treat them with too much compassion and see the other way, and I cannot be hard with them as I would be with somebody who's not related to me. And
you get to be hard?
It's hard. It's hard to be hard with disciplinarians. And a lot of that is karmic, you know. I want to share a story with you, a karmic story anyway. I'm pretty much crippled now. And it's been periodically, and people ask me, do you feel bad, you know, that you're no longer able to do the things that you used to do? And I said, no, I mean, that's the only thing I know. I mean, there's what's the alternative? But when I was a young child, you know, as before I remember, maybe 2 or 3, I lived in Chile, and I was a single child. And next door, we had neighbors that had lots of children, and in the backyard, there was a fence dividing them. And the kids next door, they used to grow chickens. And there was a hole in the fence, and the kids would used to pass me the chickens, little chicks. And I would used to chase them and break their legs. And I have no recollection. This, they told me when I go back to Chile, oh, when you were a kid, you used to do this and you used to do that. So I think the chickens are getting their revenge. Any questions?
Well, when you said that you're too attached to your children, it certainly, it just doesn't sound right to me. It feels, my attachment to my children seems to be the greatest thing in my life, in my feeling, and no hindrance. So I'm puzzled at what you say, yeah. Are you saying that you're too permissive with
yeah.
them? Which is maybe a different thing from being attached to them? You're not sure?
No, I'm not sure.
I was also curious about the same thing, because I feel like I'm coming from a place where I'm learning to accept attachments and value them and say, like, this is a good thing to be attached to the world. This is a good thing to value other people. And I guess I'm wondering what you feel like your practice is, if that's a hindrance. Because I feel like for me right now, a big part of my practice is being with those attachments and giving them a place in my life that's in balance, you know, and that's part of the work I'm doing. So I'm wondering what you feel like that is.
Could you repeat the question?
What do you feel like your practice is, that it's hindered by those attachments?
Sure, I'm not able to do the right thing as I see it.
Is attachment, is that some similar like control?
I don't think so. Attachment is sort of a feeling you have of affection, and you want to protect the other person, or you want to do what's best for them, or but in an unrealistic way that I'm not able to see them as they really are. Or it's you could say I have a codependence relationship with my children, to use a psychological jargon.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And it's like you don't, you don't feel free.
Free to do what?
To go on knowing that they're going to be okay. That.
But to tell you the truth, I'm quite conscious that my time is very limited, and our time in this earth is precious, and the opportunity to hear the Dhamma and practice it is, as Kitsai says, it's wonderful. So I know that all these things that I do, you know, they're just temporary. I'm going to die. He's going to be on his own, or he's going to have to take care of himself. So in the long run, no matter what I do, nothing is going to change. But I'm not able to do that right now. You know, it's consciously I know, but in action, I'm not quite ready to do it. is that.
Yes. Okay, thank you. So, you got two sticks there. Are you attached to your sticks? Or do you just take best care of them? I mean, in a way, you're attached, and you need to take good care of them because they keep you going. Mm-hmm. And either you don't, I guess, if you were like, I gotta have them, or I hate these things, that kind of aversion and attachment may be problematic. But still, you take best care of what you have, and is that attachment, or is that reasonable?
First of all, I am not attached to my sticks. So it really doesn't matter. It's just a thing that I use, like using a spoon or a chair. I'm not particularly attached to them. But my children's is different. I also collect instruments. One of the things I do, I make and collect string instruments. I have quite a collection, you know. But I know that as soon as I die, you know, they're just going to go their own way. And I'm just taking care of them for the time being. You know, I'm their caretaker, you know. Tune them, keep them out of the rain, play them. So that's my attitude towards things, that we're in this temporarily and we do our best. Does that answer your question? Mm-hmm. Yes, Michael.
I'm interested in your your ego shrinking and how you distinguish between sort of ego, I, and when we talk about I am doing this and that, and self. And what, is there any clear articulation of what the differences are? Or understanding?
Well, self, I guess, is more general when you're talking about your organism, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's a whole being. But ego, it's more of a, in my understanding, you know, what our habits or thoughts, our little foibles, you know, mm-hmm. our likes and dislikes. That, I think, of as ego. But this other one mind thing is not something that I personally do, it just happens. And then just I was able to contact that at the time. And it's totally transpersonal, that's the best way I can see it.
So that's no self? Is that transpersonal?
Yeah, you could say is sure, absolutely. It's, you know, oneness with all things, you know, bears and plants and chairs and things happening. It's a perceptual thing. That's what's the most uncanny thing. It wasn't really something that I thought of. It's just I just saw things I didn't see before, and mm-hmm. it scared me. You know.
And when you say I, is there a clear? When you say I am this, I'm doing, etc. Is that different from ego?
No, I is pretty much your ego. Whenever I say I, it's Jorge Morales with his whole history that's talking to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Going back to the question of the hour.
Yes.
I would say that attachment is not love. And I would say that it's actually the opposite of love. And when I'm sitting, my attachment to my children and my wife can get in the way. And because when I'm sitting, I'm just sitting. I'm not really capable of interacting with my children or my wife. So I kind of get it if you're coming from that perspective. And even when I'm not sitting, my attachment to my children and my wife is there all the time. And it's something that's I don't want to say it's in the way, but it's something that it's like a filter between me and the moment that I'm in. So, you know, I'm pretty attached to my children, and I love them too, but I don't see them that being the same.
You're absolutely right. Yes, sir.
So this musical instrument is, that you have and you talked about is a metaphor for a place you'd like to eventually be in with your children, take care of them, to keep them out of the rain, but you're going to die and they'll go to...
Yeah. It's like, you know, you go to the movie and then the show is over, you go home and you forget about the movie.
So what I would sense, though, a little, I understand that the practice, one of its great virtues is, in fact, the, as it says at the end of the, or what you say in the Doan, is resolution of relations.
Of relations, yeah.
That would be, and it's actually sung a little, gives a little more emphasis. That, in fact, is maybe a pillar of the practice, so it's a great thing, in a way, to confront or to be with that attachment.
Sure. Half the game is bringing that to awareness, you know, once you become aware of what you're doing or why you're doing or what's the problem, it's half the battle.
In the relation to my children and my wife, it...
Yes?
Paramount. Much like just what you've said, other people...
Are you guys on your first wives?
It depends on how you look at it.
No, I think part of it is that you try to find a satisfaction or salvation on other human beings, and that's not it at all. It's, no matter how loving and perfect they are, you're better off chasing the Dharma.